Again, welcome to this day and to the 24th day in Women's History Month. Well, our human existence as women goes back some 200,000 years ago to mitochondrial Eve, the ancestor that every one of us shares. Yet, sometimes we accept the myth of our origins enshrined in the Bible. Written 3,000 years ago, the story of Eve and Adam that has dominated our culture ever since. The sages who wrote the Bible had a way of ignoring the reality that without sexual intercourse between men and women, the species, Homo sapiens, would end within about a generation. As though from the beginning of time, woman was presented as truly the second sex. She was just an accessory made from the rib of Adam while he was asleep. Well, that was the first story I ever read about a human male giving life to another human being out of his body. Athena, of course, sprang from the head of Zeus. But Zeus was himself an immortal god and not a human. Then I saw the movie Junior 25 years ago. Hey, how many of you remember it? Arnold Schwarzenegger, not my favorite political figure, but one of the great comics, becomes the world's first pregnant man. As a research scientist, he receives an embryo implant with a plan to abort the fetus at the end of the first trimester. That plan goes awry. He maintains his pregnancy and gives birth, by cesarean, to a full-term baby girl named Junior. And that was the title of the film. You know, like so much of science fiction, what was once the figment of wild imagination often frames a new reality. Last year, for the first time, a healthy infant was delivered from a womb that was successfully transplanted in a woman who had been born without a uterus. So, Reuben, I've been thinking, what a weird world this will seem when a womb has been transplanted in a man who lives his dream. Rachel, I've been thinking, all the power men will face once they don't depend on women to beget the human race. So I'm laying my bets that within this century, there will be a man or men seeking that unique empowerment to have a baby without giving up all the perks and privileges of male gender. After all, just in the course of my lifespan, not to say style, women gained the freedom, on the one hand, to enjoy sexuality without risking pregnancy, thanks to birth control pills and other safe contraceptives. And on the other hand, to get pregnant without having to have sex with a male partner, thanks to sperm banks and frozen embryos. What has not changed over a couple of thousand years, though, is a culture that frames sex as sin, if it's women who are engaging in sexual intercourse. Pregnancy was not touted in the Bible as the blessed furtherance of the human race. Childbearing showed up in Genesis as the punishment for sin. When God discovers that Eve has eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, he gives her a nasty comeuppance. I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. It was pretty important in Judeo-Christian culture. When Jesus was conceived, that his mother Mary was said to enjoy the miracle of sex-free, sin-free pregnancy and childbirth. We women had a prayer when I was growing up. O Mary, Mother of God, who hath conceived without sinning, teach us to sin without conceiving. The miracles of modern science have indeed granted to women both that we may conceive without sinning and also sin without conceiving. These extraordinary changes have doubtless played their part in challenging a culture that for so long has seen women as properly ruled over by men. And it should not surprise us that some of our compatriots see these profound changes as an assault on their values. These vital issues have made their way through our legal system to be tested in the highest court of our land. For a time, a commitment to the equality of women and their right to decide the use of their bodies seemed paramount. 8 years before the case of Roe versus Wade, in 1965, the Supreme Court decided a case called Griswold versus Connecticut. That decision overturned a state's ban on the use of contraceptives by married couples. The ban had been in force since 1879, and it read, any person who uses any drug, medicinal article, or instrument for the purposes of preventing conception shall be fined not less than $40, which was quite a bit in 1879, or imprisoned not less than 60 days. Those same penalties apply to anyone who assists, abets, counsels, hires, or commands the use of contraceptives. The basic argument in Griswold versus Connecticut was that the right to privacy, while never explicit in the Constitution, was implicit in the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. It affirmed the right of people to be free of intrusion by the government into one's personal life and relationships. And a later decision of the court found that same right for unmarried couples as well. Yet, the clamor against legalizing contraception is as boisterous now as it was in 1965. It arises in the urgency to strip birth control pill coverage from medical insurance, in regulations that allow employers to deny coverage to their employees for contraceptives, in laws that support pharmacists who hold it immoral that they have to fill prescriptions for birth control pills. Back in 2012, when Rush Limbaugh heard Georgetown Law School student Sandra Fluke tell a House committee why her Catholic school's health insurance should have to offer contraceptive drugs without a copay, Rush Limbaugh exploded. Essentially, she says she must be paid to have sex. It makes her a slut, right? It makes her a prostitute. She's having so much sex, she can't afford the contraception. He had the idea that, sort of like using a condom, a woman would have to take a pill just before she had sex in order to prevent conception. Contraception is flat-out thievery, he went on, that would force taxpayers to pay to satisfy the sexual habits of female law students at Georgetown. Roe versus Wade, decided in the Supreme Court in January 1973, also affirmed a constitutional right to privacy. But the issues that decision laid out are far more complex. Essentially, Roe versus Wade was three decisions. It laid out a different legal standing for a fetus in each three-month span of pregnancy. And it addressed issues that went far beyond the right to privacy. A pregnant single woman, Jane Roe, was challenging the Texas law that banned abortion except to save the life of the mother. A critical part of the state's argument was that the fetus is a person with 14th Amendment rights of its own. They argued that life begins at conception and is present throughout pregnancy, and therefore the state has a compelling interest in protecting that life from and after conception. The Supreme Court in Roe, however, found that a woman had a qualified right, not a total right, to terminate her pregnancy, while the interest of the state differed with each trimester of pregnancy. The state had argued that abortion at any time was hazardous to the woman, but the court saw the facts that mortality rates for abortion in early pregnancy were, if anything, lower than mortality rates for normal childbirth. On the other hand, the court found unpersuasive the argument, quote, that a woman's right is absolute and that she's entitled to terminate her pregnancy at whatever time, in whatever way, and for whatever reason she alone chooses. The court considered that a state may properly assert important interests in safeguarding health, in maintaining medical standards, and in protecting potential life. The unborn have never been recognized in the law, however, as persons in the whole sense. But once the fetus was viable, and that was considered in the third trimester, those last 3 months of pregnancy, a state could ban abortion except where it was necessary to preserve the mother's life. In the 46 years since Roe versus Wade, the controversy has grown more shrill, if anything. The personhood of a fetus has taken center stage. Just 19 years later, the Supreme Court essentially eviscerated Roe versus Wade in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. States are now free to pressure women with information to persuade them to have a baby instead of an abortion. They're free to set rules for hospitals and medical professionals that reduce access and increase the costs. And states may require parental notification by pregnant teenagers. All of these state acts are cast as not being an undue burden on the pregnant woman. And there are no clear guidelines that distinguish a due burden from an undue burden. So about 30 of our 50 states have laws that now push the limits on burdens. Although nearly 1 million known pregnancies end in miscarriage or stillbirth annually, some states now prosecute a miscarriage or stillbirth as possible manslaughter since the fetus has personhood. This is from the New York Times. Women who fell down the stairs, who ate a poppy seed bagel and failed a drug test, or who took legal drugs during pregnancy that had been prescribed by their doctors, all have been accused of endangering their children. If our Supreme Court today, 2019, with its conservative majority, rules that the fetus does have personhood rights under the Constitution, all abortions become illegal. A pregnant woman may find her most personal decisions coming under state control. Will she be charged with a crime if she chooses to smoke cigarettes or drink wine, and this plays some part in a miscarriage? What if a judge rules or a police officer believes that she's risking the life of a fetus by, say, climbing a mountain or riding a roller coaster? Who will decide whether a pregnant woman who's been diagnosed with cancer may undergo chemotherapy? Yet, we're faced with a grievous contradiction between the intense concern for the personhood of a fetus, of its right to life in the womb, and the tepid or absent concern for the life of that infant who makes it through to childbirth. The United States has double or triple the infant mortality rate of other wealthy developed countries. About 6 American infants die in their first year for every 1,000 live births. Mortality rates vary by state. In Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi, for example, it's more than 8 out of 1,000 babies who die in their first year. Prematurity is the leading cause, and second, our birth defects. A major issue is the lack of universal access to quality prenatal care. Interestingly, compared to worldwide statistics, American babies have good survival rates in their first few weeks of life. It's only after they reach 1 month of age that differences begin to widen between survival in the U.S. and other developed countries. That's not surprising. The state of California, for instance, automatically covers babies under the parents' health insurance plan, but that coverage is just for the first 30 days. On day 31, the infant will need his or her own insurance policy, and that takes time, paperwork, and money. Social programs in many European countries provide free home visits from nurses for new parents, programs that are very rare in the United States. And parental leave policies have enormous effect on health outcomes for mothers and babies. The U.S. has higher poverty rates and a weaker social safety net, and that leads to more infant deaths. Looking beyond even the first year of life, American children aged 1 to 19 are less likely to survive than children in these other developed countries. The U.S. spends the most on health care per capita compared to these other countries. Yet, we spend more on health care to take care of children who are already sick, and we spend less money on welfare programs to keep kids from becoming sick. Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi, with their extra high infant mortality rate, are among the states with the most restrictive and burdensome laws against abortion. This tells us that the right to life of a fetus with personhood expires at the moment of birth, at the moment that baby exits from the womb. Its soul, that's presumed to make it a person from conception onward, is of no further significance. to the States. It suggests that the supposed concern for the life of the fetus is but a thin gloss for the ancient view that the pain and threat of childbirth to the life of the mother is, after all, her just punishment for sin, her sexual activity. So address sin by banning contraception and abortion. As Americans, as human beings, it's time for us to step back and question these challenges our culture presents. The rights of personhood in the womb have grown in significance in a court system now packed with jurists who are poised to overturn or further eviscerate Roe versus Wade. Will anything turn back that tide? Reuben, I've been thinking that a new culture with new legal tenets might define us once there are men who fulfill their deepest dream of parenting by seeking the transplant of a uterus. Let's imagine for a moment a pregnant man in his 30s is carrying this fetus, this person within him, in his transplanted womb. Suddenly, he faces the unexpected loss of his job, his income, his health insurance. What choices will he face? What will the law permit? Imagine a man who, late into his pregnancy, is diagnosed with a form of cancer that can be treated with chemotherapy, but the chemo will destroy the fetus. What will he choose? What will the law permit? Imagine a man who grievously finds the fetus has died within his body. He had been out mountain climbing, long a joy of his life. Will he be charged with manslaughter? I believe there will be a new tomorrow, led perhaps by men who assert the right to bear children, though it will be a long day coming. Someday, we will live in that miraculous world where everyone who wants to bear a child can bear a child, and everyone who declines pregnancy can prevent or end pregnancy. Until then, too many of our newborns are dying for lack of prenatal care and for lack of medical care after birth and in their childhood. It's time for compassion to waken in our hearts and for compassion to reign in the halls where laws are made and in the courts where rights are affirmed. Why should the right of life, the right to life, be affirmed only in the womb? Why can't we all value the personhood of all our children? Why can't we give health care to all of them as a right? Indeed, when does personhood end? I pray that states take on the task of persuading more than just pregnant mothers to affirm the right to life for all persons, for all babies and children, and yes, us elderly and people in between. Universal health care? Yes, the time is now. The right to life from the womb to the tomb. Namaste.